And I'd like to welcome Thomas. My guest, Thomas Dolby, has had a varied career in music, technology, and film. He is at a hand in scoring films for directors Ken Russell and George Lucas, pioneering the technology that brought ringtones to your cell phone, and of course, infectious, compact, hummable tunes that filled our radios with hits like Hyperactive and She Blinded Me with Science. Thomas Dolby is appearing tonight at the Sellersville Theater, presenting his new project, The Invisible Lighthouse, a film which will be presented as Thomas both narrates and plays music for the film and from his storied career. Welcome, Thomas Dolby, to the WDIY studios today.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here, Keith.
Yeah, it's great. Great to see you. All right. Well, The Invisible Lighthouse, this is an interesting project. You made this film kind of as a DIY effort, a do-it-yourself effort, and it includes finding, I heard about a drone helicopter that you had to film you from the air while you were making it. Tell us about the process of the filmmaking. Did you have a crew at all, or were you doing this wholly alone?
When I started the project, I was just going out with my smartphone and sort of talking, you know, into my phone as I shot scenes from around where I live. It was prompted because I heard about a year ago that a lighthouse was closing down on an island that I can see from my home. And I've seen the flash of that lighthouse on my bedroom wall ever since I was a little boy. And I decided to make a film about it, thinking that I was going to hire a crew, but I ended up going the DIY route, right down to performing it live and doing the narration and score and even sound effects live every night in theaters. So for now, the only way to experience The Invisible Lighthouse is to come and see a show and see me actually performing the soundtrack live.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. You know, I read where you're traveling with a musician who's also a Foley artist. And
yeah.
His name is Blake Lee?
Yeah, it's pronounced Lay. Blake is actually a world-famous sound designer and music supervisor. He did movies like The Abyss and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and he was music supervisor on Tremé and The Wire.
Oh, wow.
So he's really world-class, and I'm very lucky to have him slumming it on the road with me. But what he does on stage is Foley is the art of real-time sound effects. So you've probably seen, you know, footage of guys with like a tray of gravel or floorboards or twigs or leaves making wind and thunder and lightning sounds and the rustling of material. That's Foley. And Blake is doing some of that live in real time and processing it through his computer in real time to make a sort of descriptive, impressionistic soundtrack. And he plays a bit of guitar as well.
Mm-hmm. That should be quite an experience. I don't think I've ever been in the presence of a Foley artist as he does his work.
Well, a lot of people are doing live soundtracks to silent movies now, but this is sort of taking it a stage further because, for a start, all of the soundtrack, including the sound effects, is being done on stage. And also it's the filmmaker there in the theater with you, so it's a bit different from watching, you know, a 100-year-old black and white movie with a modern score.
So you'll be interacting with the film, as it were.
Yeah, so you're as the audience, your attention is constantly drawn from the screen to what's going on stage and back again. We have other things. We have props. You know, there's a section where I'm talking about, you know, what happened during World War II on the coast where I live in Britain. You know, we were constantly under threat of invasion from Nazis, but before that, from Napoleon, and before that, I don't know, the Vikings. And so it's always the front line, you know, whenever there's a war on. But for that section of the film, you know, we sort of go to, you know, red lights. We put on our World War II military police helmets. We have a genuine World War II air raid siren going off and red lights flashing on the stage and things. So the whole performance happens very theatrically on a number of different levels.
That's great. Well, I've been a part of, you know, to witness your Soul Inhabitant tour and the other tour you did last year. And it was definitely a sights and sounds and really amazing partaking to just look at, you know, be aware of.
Well, I love mixing in novel elements when I play live. I've never been a virtuoso keyboard player. So, you know, I look at sort of great jazz musicians and stuff that can just, you know, sit down cross-legged on the stage and entertain an audience with their fingers for a couple of hours. I'm sort of in awe of that. But my skill has always been to mix in other elements, going right back to, you know, MTV video days when I wrote and directed some of my own videos, including for She Blinded Me with Science and so on, through to the whole multimedia interactive era, you know, of the 90s, the mobile era when I was working in mobile phones and things like that. And now really on to today, where it's becoming possible because of the fantastic technology and breakthroughs that are happening in film cameras and editing software and stuff, you know, for a guy like me to go out and make a film of his own without any budget or funding.
Yeah, I guess the technology is pretty easy for anybody to just, you know, purchase and figure it out, read the manuals, and then really get a sense of what they want to do.
Well, this is something that happened in music, you know, 20, 25 years ago. And it meant that suddenly, instead of needing to get a record contract and therefore, you know, get funded to go in the studio and get on the radio and so on, you know, you could make a record in your back room all of a sudden. And the internet came along, you could put it on YouTube and get, you know, global distribution. And so that's a great leveler. Now, the downside is, you know, there's a lot of mediocrity as well. But there's some diamonds in the rough, you know, kids that are talented that we probably never would have got to hear if they had to start by getting a cassette to an A&R. Man.
Right.
And I think the same thing is happening now in film. You know, I think some of those waiters that are bussing tables and, you know, writers and directors can actually club together, pull their savings and go out and make feature films.
Agreed. I should add that I've read that The Invisible Lighthouse won a Best Director and Best Documentary Short Awards at the DIY Festival this year. Which is great. Congratulations for that.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. I wasn't really expecting any awards for my first film. But in many ways, I think there's a lot of similarities to, certainly in the editing process, to editing music and sound. You know, you take a couple of chunks of media, you stick them together and they look like crap, but you massage them a little bit and use some special effects and paper over the seams and you start to have it turn into something. You know?
Yeah, give the people a show.
Yeah.
Well, I guess director J.J. Abrams, he's a fan.
Yeah, you've
palled around with him, I've heard.
I've known JJ since he's about 21 years old. And when I first started on The Invisible Lighthouse, I showed JJ some of my rough works. And I said, what do you think? Do I need to find somebody to do this properly? And he said, no. What's special about what you've got is it has a voice. It has a personality. And that's all too missing in so many Hollywood movies. Don't worry about the production stuff. It's plenty good enough. What you should focus on is the storytelling and the personality and the passion behind your film. And so he was very supportive and encouraging to me. And he sort of stayed in touch, you know, over the whole process. And he came down to see one of my shows earlier in the year. But I guess now he's off in the UK making Star Wars. So he probably won't be at Sellersville tonight.
No. Well, maybe he'll give you a call for future work.
That would be good.
Actually, which I was going to ask, any future films to add to your resume? Any projects maybe ongoing?
You know, what I really like about maverick filmmaking is that when I made The Invisible Lighthouse, I had nobody to answer to. I had nobody breathing down my neck, you know, telling me what I should and shouldn't do. And that's the way I've always worked. And I think the individuality of my work is what really sets it apart. So, no, I'm not about to get in the next plane to Hollywood and start pitching, you know, feature film ideas to studios. But I think that, you know, this sort of new age of maverick filmmaking is something that I'm very excited to be a part of. There are other great stories that need to get told other than mine, stories that never would have gotten funded through the studio system. And I'd like to use the new skills that I've acquired, you know, making The Invisible Lighthouse, and maybe apply them to somebody else's life altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I looked through the DIY Film Festival website, and there were definitely a lot of interesting films that I had no idea about.
Yeah, I mean, there's some really... I've been out in the circuit, done a couple of film festivals. We were just in Orlando at a film festival a couple of days ago. And there's some really amazing stuff being done by people that just maxed out their credit cards, you know, and bought some equipment and just went and did it. Now, admittedly, a lot of them are zombie movies, you know, but they're not... there's a few that don't have any rotting flesh in.
I sense there's a zombie song in there somewhere for Thomas Dolby in the future.
Well, we're coming up to Halloween, so maybe it's about time.
Yeah. Well, actually, the next question I was going to ask, because you've been performing this for a few months now in Europe and the UK and now in America, Is the Invisible Lighthouse an ongoing project from night to night? Do some things change between the performances? Do you add or take away?
Yeah, it really varies, actually. It's a little bit fluid. It's a bit different every night. And so it truly is a theatrical experience when you come down. And I think everybody that's come has been sort of blown away, really, because it's unlike anything else you've seen. It really is transmedia. It's sort of mixing up media. And it's a very heartfelt, personal story. So, you know, I hope people will enjoy it. It's unlike anything else that I've done, that's for sure.
Well, we want to just mention that Thomas is playing tonight at the Sellersville Theater. You can log on to st94.com for more information on the performance tonight at 8 p.m. And I'm sure there are tickets left, but do not delay and call now and log on to the website, st94.com. Your songs have always evoked atmospheres, vistas, and places to go, a vast world waiting to be discovered. For example, Budapest by Blimp was one of my favorites. That just is a film in and of itself. This film seems like a continuance of that voice of through your songwriting about discovery.
Well, I've never been one to write songs about text message breakups and things like that. You know, a lot of postmodern music is very in the moment. You know, it's eight bars of groove with a riff over the top, and then we change to a new groove and a new riff. And my songwriting is very conventional in some ways. It has an arc to it. It has an intro, verses, choruses, characters, location, and so on. It's all about atmosphere, really. And the things that have inspired me, you know, to write songs have always been geography, travel, atmospheric conditions, space, the planet.
Science.
Science, yeah, those kinds of things. Yeah. But I always manage, I hope, to sort of find the human element in all of that. And yeah, as you say, I mean, many of my songs have a sort of cinematic quality to them. And you worry slightly when you actually put pictures, you know, to music, that you're sort of replacing the imagination that people have in their own minds. But The Invisible Lighthouse is a very impressionistic piece. And many people come and see it. And some of them say, well, I have a pet lighthouse in my past as well. But others say, you know, there's this park that I used to go to, or there's this creek, or there's this mountain that I used to slide down. And I think a lot of our childhood memories are often wrapped up in monuments and landmarks and places like that. And many of them are disappearing. And one thing you have to deal with as you get older is you have to sort of let go of some of that, because you can't stop the march of progress. But I've definitely touched a nerve, you know, with this film. And people seem to get emotionally very wrapped up in it.
Yeah, I've always had a likeness for lighthouses also. I kind of wanted to live in a lighthouse, you know, at one point in my childhood. It's just a beauty and a starkness to it that gets you in touch with the elements.
Well, I know one you could go and live in, and that's the one that just closed down this year off the coast of Suffolk. It's the thing is, there's very bad coastal erosion in the county where I live. Combination of the geology of Britain, where the British Isles are actually tilting towards the east, so the sea level is rising. Thousands of years ago, there was no sea between us and Europe. We're attached to Europe. So the North Sea is a relatively new thing. And then add to that global warming and the erosion of the North Sea storms washing down the coast. And the lighthouse in question actually lost about 200 yards of beach in a single night a couple of winters ago. And the beach in front of our house is actually way wider than it used to be. But the whole coast is very fluid. And when we have high tides, we get cut off from the mainland. And you'd have to take a boat to get across. My kids want us to get the heck out of there because they're worried there'll be no inheritance for them, you know. But I love it. It's exciting, yeah. You know. And it's like I'll be the last rat off the ship.
Nice. I remember years ago when you said you were moving back to England to get the kids, I guess, better schooling and just to go back to where you grew up. And it sounds like a very just a romantic, evocative place to just be inspired by. And I'm sure you do in your boat that you've rehabbed into a studio. What's it called again?
The Nutmeg of Consolation. That's yeah,
great.
It was
a
1930s ship's lifeboat that I bought on eBay. And I replaced the diesel engine with a bank of batteries, and I've got a turbine on the roof and solar panels and so on. And it now runs entirely on renewable energy. And I sit and stare out to sea all day, and people wonder how I get any work done. And I have to say, well, that's me working. You know, that's actually how I come up with stuff. I become a bit of a train spotter because there's a container port near us. And I watch these giant container ships go in and out of the port. And I can sort of track them on via radar on the website. And I just love the atmosphere there. This is not the Britain that, you know, a lot of Americans think of the, you know, the rolling green hills and Buckingham Palace. it's a very mysterious atmospheric coast. And the island where the lighthouse is was formerly owned by the Ministry of Defense, and it's covered with unexploded bombs, you know, so they don't like people wandering around out there. And they gave me no cooperation at all in making my film.
So you had to do this kind of clandestine, just to...
Well, I decided to do a raid on the island in a commando raid in a speedboat. And I had to get up very early in the morning and get out there before the docents showed up on the island. And so it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek James Bond. But
yeah, the trailer is quite intriguing. Really well done, the trailer.
Well, thank you. It sort of fits with, you know, because, I mean, a lot of the film, what's really going on is just an exploration of childhood memories, you know, about the unreliability of childhood memories. And so I was sent away to boarding school when I was 7 years old, you know, which is why I'm so messed up, I think. And, you know, so re-exploring some of my childhood memories via this lighthouse, which I remember as having this sweeping epic beam that lit up the night, you know, going back and seeing it's really this puny little flash, you know, was a bit disturbing. And so I use it as a way to explore, you know, childhood memories and how we have implanted memories, you know, that we can't depend on.
Right. Self-therapy.
Exactly.
Well, we're taking advantage of that, the public at large, and thank you for doing this work. I was just going to mention the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse is a big, huge tourist attraction, and they've pulled that back like 300 yards because it was going to erode, but because I guess the money's there or whoever, they pulled it back. So,
yeah, well, it's fantastic they're able to do that. I mean, there have been some success stories. You know, there was an act through Congress in, I think, 1990, which is like a sort of a footnote to the Parks and National Monuments Act, which was seeking to help preserve lighthouses. And many of them have been moved into the public domain now, or private domain, sorry, rather. They've become bed and breakfast and things like that. But there's still a doomsday list of 46 lighthouses around the North American coast where they're going to either erode and fall into the sea or they're getting vandalized and so on. And it's a real shame, but in a certain way, you have to realize this is a transitional technology. It sort of bridges the gap between celestial navigation and smartphones and laptops. You know, I mean, the average weekend yachtsman has got more than enough navigation on his iPhone, you know. So there's less need for them, but at the same time, they're so precious to us, and I think they should be preserved.
I'm going to go up to Maine, I think, next week, and there's one. Quoddy Head is the furthest northernest point in Maine in America, and there's a little lighthouse there. And a friend went, and he said that you have to go across, and there's a big sign, and the tides come in within literally 5 to 10 minutes. You're in 12 feet of water, so if you don't get over at a certain point twice a day, you're stuck there for another 12 hours. So
I love that stuff.
I know. So a friend went with his buddy, and they saw this young couple with children going across, and they did you read the sign? They said, oh yeah, we read it. And he said that he thinks they spent the night because it was within 20 minutes of submerging, and they were going to be shut off, and that's it.
Well, they probably wouldn't be the first. No, I mean, I find it fascinating. I look at these lighthouses and I think, well, they've looked on, you know, over repelled invasions and great hurricanes and sea battles and things, you know, and there's just such a sense of history to them. And this is a relatively young country, you know, and I just think pieces of our history like that should really be looked after. The issue slightly is that, you know, that they fall under the Coast Guard's budget, but they're nothing but a drain on the budget. You know, they don't serve that much of a function anymore. So, I mean, I think one of the things would be to transfer the responsibility into somebody that has budget specifically to preserve these things.
Yeah, Bill Gates, help us out. Very well. Very, very good. Thomas Dolby's performing his film and performance of The Invisible Lighthouse tonight at Sellersville Theater. Log on to st94.com for more information. I just have a few more questions for you, Thomas, before I let you on your way. I'm sure you have a busy day. your career has only garnered a handful of releases, but each with a great sonic palette and thoughtful intellectual take on history and humanity. Is there a whole process from the initial thought to recording, then to mixing and mastering, that's more time than, say, most pop stars and dance artists put it, you know, two or three albums out every other year? Lucinda Williams comes to mind. She takes a lot of time between her work, and I'm really appreciative of the time that she and then you take in your between your, you know, your albums. So if it's another 5-8 years, some people would be like, come on, let's go, and I'm just like, take your time.
Well, that's very sweet of you. Yeah, I mean, I bumped into Peter Gabriel the other day, and he's sort of prolific by my standards, you know. I have no chemical need to, you know, put out an album every year or a couple of years even. Some people do. I mean, I did a lot of work with a band called Prefab Sprout, and Paddy McAloon, who is their writer, could easily put out 4 albums a year if he wanted to. He writes that many songs, but many of them never see the light of day, and so he has this vault of stuff that people have never heard. I know, you know, Prince is the same.
I was going to say Prince.
But I have no vault. I mean, there's nothing I've written that you haven't heard.
Wow.
There's you know, a few B-sides and so on that didn't show up anywhere else, but there's nothing lurking in the closet at all. It's either good enough to do right and put out on a record, or it's not worth finishing at all. You know, there's no in between for me. Right. So it may easily be a few years before I come out with another one. I like the fact, though, nowadays that you can come at it from different angles. You know, I could start with a film next time and have the music be a soundtrack, or I could start with a game. There's all sorts of different ways to do it. I could put out individual songs. I could put out EPs. I could put out a demo of a song, you know, on my blog, and then come back and change the second verse 2 months later. I mean, I like the flexibility of that, because in the old days, record companies, you know, the whole system used to sort of cookie cut your right. albums, tours, etc.
Sure.
You had to fit into these specific marketing windows. And that wasn't very comfortable for me, and I think not for a lot of artists. You know, I think for many musicians, I think the way you think about your songs, the way your songs evolve, is much more fluid than that. So it's really against the grain to sort of force them and say, you know, here is a snapshot of these 10 songs. I'm going to put that out and live with it the rest of my career. That's not natural for a musician.
Well, for example, your interactive game, A Map of the Floating City, that was I didn't play it personally, but I heard it was really interesting and a new way to put forth your material.
Well, it was great fun to do. It was a multi-user online game. It was free, and it brought in a lot of gamers who were sort of interested in the gameplay but had never heard my music. But they had to cooperate with hardcore Dolby fans who knew the obscure answers to you know, questions about lyrics and things like that. So it, on a certain level, it opened up a new audience. And I constantly find that, you know, when my songs are used in a different context, like, you know, Hyperactive was in Grand Theft Auto, you know, one of the early ones, you would hijack this old sort of Mustang or something like that and, you know, kick out the owner, and you'd be driving along and Hyperactive would come on the radio, and that was kind of cool. And then recently,
nice.
I think is it Brad from Breaking Bad? Is that his name? Anyway, one of the protagonists, I haven't watched the show, but apparently one of the main characters in Breaking Bad had She Blinded Me with Science as his ringtone.
Nice.
In like the third to last episode, when people are getting really excited about it. And that sort of, it was rather cute because of my involvement with ringtones myself and
sure.
so on. And it was rather nice that it sort of, you know, completed that circle.
I always imagine certain friends, I would give them a ringtone, you know, certain artists, and definitely you were definitely one of them. I was just going to ask about Peter Gabriel. Did you actually work with him? I know you work with many people throughout your history.
No, I've never actually worked with him. I recorded one of the songs on my new album at Real World Studios, which is his place outside Bath. And I've met him a few times over the years. He's a really nice guy. He comes to TED a lot. You know, I was music director at TED for
sure.
12 years, and he was a regular there. And he was he didn't perform, but he would just sit for 4 days and just take in every speech, and he absolutely loved it. I think he told me that, you know, he learned more in 4 days at TED than from a whole year of like reading the papers and watching TV.
That's great. A friend called the New World Studios, I think, is his
Real World. Yeah.
He called to purchase one of the things he was putting out, Big Blue Ball or something, And he called, and the person picked up the phone, and my friend said, "Is this Peter?" He goes, "Yes, this is Peter." He goes, "Oh, the secretary's called out sick, so I'm answering phones." I thought that was quite fun. So out of your varied and prolific career, I'm sure you have a bunch of highlights, possibly dangling 90 feet in the air from the recreation of the wall with Roger Waters, possibly performing live with David Bowie. Any highlights that you want to?
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be two. I really liked doing the 101 concert at the Rose Bowl with Depeche Mode. That was another highlight. You know, it just seemed to be really the pinnacle of a certain sound and a certain movement, right, you know, at the end of the 80s. And so that was a lot of fun. But no, I mean, I've been very fortunate that you know, I seem to have the respect of my peers. So I get invited to go and do things like that. And I mean, I think another one would be playing with Stevie Wonder and Herbie Hancock and Howard Jones at the Grammys in 1985. And that was also a special moment.
That was very memorable for me, seeing the four of you jam out. That was awesome. Very, very cool. Well, I just want to thank our guest, Thomas Dolby, today for coming into The Blend, WDIY. We love our call letters, too, by the way, so we're glad you came. The do-it-yourself ethic for Thomas's new project film, The Invisible Lighthouse, playing today at Sellersville Theater. Log on to st94.com for more information. 8 p.m. is the show, and you can see Thomas and his Foley artist, musician Blake Lay, playing and presenting the Invisible Lighthouse. I'm really, really looking forward to the show tonight, Thomas. I want to thank you for coming by.
All right, Keith, thanks for having me.
WDIY. We're gonna go out with a track from Thomas's first album, The Golden Age of Wireless, from 1982, and Thomas has picked out one of our submarines for the outro for today's interview. Thanks, Tom. Thomas, we will see you tonight.
Excellent.
That's st94.org or .com for more information about the concert tonight. The Invisible Lighthouse, presented by Thomas Dolby.